I'd like to discuss a little bit about the U.S. markets and how they closed on February the 8th. Just some basic news to get us started here. The S&P closed up almost 2 points after being down 24 points. The Dow closed the day down 63 points after being down 286 points, so quite the turnaround on the Dow. The NASDAQ was up and closed for the day around 10 points after being down 63 points. And the Russell 2000, the small cap index, closed up 77 cents after being down 10 points. So quite the swing in all of the major indices for the U.S. stock markets. This capped the seventh straight week of gains. It is really my opinion that the U.S. markets are in no man's land at this point. The amount of volatility, the amount of uncertainty, the amount of headline news that comes from the president tweeting, chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jay Powell, reversing course, communications and damage control, sending out former chairman Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen to say everything's okay, the Fed's here to coddle everybody, don't worry, the economy's strong. Autopilot on unwinding the Fed's balance sheet was just a misstatement. I'm bad, guys. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say that. That's Jay Powell. He was a comedian in college. He doesn't know what he's talking about. So out comes Uncle Ben and Aunt Jellen and Aunt Janet, and they say, hey, everything's fine. The Fed's here. It's not on autopilot. We're going to do a wait and see. We know you were coming down from that high, but don't worry, we got your fix. We're going to take care of you. And then the markets rallied. And then you have all your breadcrumbs and all the rumors flying out from every which direction. U.S.-China trade talks. Something serious is about to happen, folks. Something serious, and something good. Something real good. Just got to wait for it. And then, not so much. But the markets still go up, despite bad news coming from around the world. Fourth quarter earnings, back and forth. Depends on the sector, depends on the company. Some beat expectations. Some didn't. Some beat expectations and their share price fell. Others were worse than expected, but maybe they had a share price increase. The logic and reasoning of these markets is ridiculous. It's insane. Well, because they didn't lose as much as we thought they were going to lose, so they rallied. Or they didn't beat as much as we thought they were going to beat, so it collapses. Well, you didn't think they were going to beat. You had expectations of it being $100, and it was $102, or whatever it was. We expected a dollar in earnings, and they came out at $1.08 on earnings. I'm telling you, it takes a lot of luck. You can have all the skill in the world and pat yourself on the back, but I'm telling you, when it comes to stock picking, luck is definitely a part of the equation. And we continue to have further breadcrumbs in regards to U.S.-China trade talks. I spoke yesterday how White House Economic Advisor Larry Kudlow came out and said, we're going to continue talks, but we're still miles away from making a deal. And the markets just sold off like crazy. I'm telling you, folks, this is the quintessential buy the rumor, sell the fact story. U.S.-China trade relations. And don't forget, we are less than 1 month away from the March 1st deadline as to whether or not these two countries strike a deal. And if a deal is not struck, what's going to happen with the tariff situation? Are more tariffs going to be placed on Chinese goods? And likewise, will the Chinese place reciprocal tariffs on U.S. goods? I said this yesterday. If a deal is not struck, but tariffs on both sides are increased, markets are just going to sell off like mad, or they could. Barring some miraculous tweet from the president or some rabbit out of the hat move from the Federal Reserve, there'd really be nothing to stop it. And that goes to another point I want to make. Now you're starting to see in some of the mainstream financial news, CNBC, Bloomberg, Fox Business, you're starting to see pundits and analysts. I don't know. I mean, yeah, the Federal Reserve, they might actually reverse course. They might actually reverse course. They might actually do a rate cut. They might actually embark on another leg, another round of quantitative easing. If they do this, ladies and gentlemen, the Federal Reserve has no credibility. They've already lost all credibility in my mind. And for those of you who are in the know and pay attention to this stuff, I'm sure you have no respect for them as well. They've lost credibility on your side as well. You can't have a group of economists of the highest caliber, we're told, predicting the economy. You make policy on those predictions, on all of that brain power, and then boom, you're wrong, and you want to reverse course. Well, if you're no good at predicting, then don't even predict. Don't hold the market's hand. Don't come out and give press conferences and coach markets. Don't coach the addict and tell him you're going to take his drug away from him. So prepare yourself. And then when you do, he throws a hissy fit and you reverse course. You give him his fix again. You're losing all credibility. Now nobody can ignore it. That's the point where we've come to. I talked the other day about diminishing marginal returns and the efficacy of quantitative easing and interest rate hikes and cuts. If Federal Reserve economists continue to push this policy, if other central banks around the world, as I discussed the other day, that are either holding their own policy or in some instances, in the case of the Reserve Bank of India, they're cutting rates. And of course, that was for political purposes, but of course, we're also told that central banks are supposed to be independent of political elections and policies and whatnot. Well, the Prime Minister of India has a parliamentary election coming up, so, you know, we'll try to stimulate the economy for you, Prime Minister, because we like you, you know. They're losing all credibility, folks. If these quantitative easing bullets lose their efficacy, we're all in a lot of trouble. We're all in a lot of trouble regardless. But now the tool in the toolbox isn't working. The carpenter's hammer can't hammer down the nail. That's a problem. Because if they're not effective with more quantitative easing, with more funny money being printed out of thin air, if fiscal policy wants to blow up their deficits to try to stimulate economic growth doesn't work, then I don't know where the bottom of the markets and where the economy will eventually end up. I don't mean to paint a doom and gloom scenario, but I'm not going to sit here and lie to you either. This is the reality of which we live. This is the reality of which we have allowed to be created because we don't hold the Federal Reserve accountable. We don't hold our politicians accountable. We would rather focus on non-issues. Trump collusion. Russia, every day for 2 years. No end in sight. We'd rather talk about a wall on the southern border. While it may be needed, is not the biggest issue we're facing at the moment. Distractions. Don't focus on unfunded liabilities. Don't focus on the demographics of this country that are not working in our favor. Don't focus on the demographics that are not working in major developed countries all over the world. Don't pay attention to these things. They're meaningless. Pay attention to Trump Russia and to all the drama that's taking place in Washington, D.C. with politicians. Listen to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez because, you know, she's a genius. And pay attention to a wall on the border. Don't pay attention to $22 trillion in debt. Don't pay attention to financial hacks who are pulling the economic levers of this global economy, printing funny money, which inflates our currency, which means it diminishes our purchasing power, so it's stealing from us, right under our very noses. I've written about this in The Cynic's Guide to Investing. If we don't fix this and hold those in power accountable, the market will fix it for us. Well, we're at that point now, ladies and gentlemen. I believe that. I don't think there's much more we can do at this point. The horse has left the barn. He's gone. Giddy up. It will not be pretty. But because this market is in no man's land, I can't sit here and tell you when this is going to happen. We've had 7 weeks of market gains. So what we might be witnessing is just a minor pullback, a general market correction. We entered overbought scenario in the markets. So this is just a little correction, and then it may continue to the upside. Who knows? I don't know. I'm not going to sit here and pretend to know what the markets are going to do on a day-to-day basis. That's a fool's errand. And I'm not going to get suckered in to playing that game because I simply don't know. I'm not smart enough to know whether the market's going to go up tomorrow or it's going to go down the next day thereafter. All I look for is, generally speaking, if one looks logically at the economic data and the situation of what's taking place, then I would have to think, if you're a rational, reasonable person, you would have to agree with me, at least to some degree. You can't have this type of economic slowdown occurring all around the world and for it not to have some effect on the U.S. economy and stock markets the world over. You know, there's some things that I look at. And I'm not here to give you advice as to what you should do. You can go seek professional help out there with your financial advisors, your accountants, your lawyers, you know, tax specialists, whatever. But I am going to tell you maybe what I do personally and what you should look into. So we had a pretty big market sell-off in the last quarter of last year, 2018. And I thought something was coming. It was really in the beginning of 2018, definitely towards the end of summer, I really started to get the jitters. I was like, you know, how much longer can these guys keep this stuff propped up? And it was making me nervous because I had done well in the market over the past several years, not because I'm a genius, but because I was a buy and hold guy and the Federal Reserve was printing all this money. So it went up. You know, anybody who wants to pat themselves on the back over this past decade as being some sort of stock-picking genius, I mean, you know, call them out on it. say, well, you know, did you tell the Federal Reserve to do this, that, and the other? You printing that funny money? Of course they're not. Everybody looked like a genius because the Federal Reserve printed funny money that was designed to inflate financial assets. So go out and buy financial assets. But as I said, diminishing marginal returns has to kick in somewhere. And so I thought from a risk-return standpoint, I did fairly well over these past several years. I worked hard for that money. I'm not just going to give it up to what I think might be coming, which is a significant drop-off. So I put a lot of money on the sidelines. Yes, I still have long positions. I even have short positions on this market. But I took a lot of money off the table. And so the majority of my portfolio was not subject to that 20% drop-off. Now, you have to understand how big a 20% drop-off is in context. Say you have $100. If you lose 20%, that takes you down to $80. To get back to where you were at that $100, you now have to make a return of 25%. Okay? Make sense? A 25% rally return getting back to even, that's a big move. That's a real big move. If you make 25% per year, you're considered legendary. You're a hero for the year. And if you can continue to do it, you're really legendary. They're going to write books about you if you can make 25% a year. So this comes all down to the school of thought with investing, right? I mean, are you going to be a buy and hold guy? Are you a day trader? Do you, you know, are you a swing trader? Maybe you get involved with some options and you look out a few months and that's how you play things. It's really very specific to the individual what you want to do, your risk tolerance, your experience with the market, your trust in your financial advisor if you delegate that responsibility to somebody else. But let's look at buy and hold for a second, right? Because this is where it gets really personal. If you're somebody who has 40 years ahead of you to invest, a 20% decline is really not that big of a deal. You have 40 years to invest, you have 40 years of earning power, and you have 40 years to allow compounding interest to really work its miracle and magic for you. So when it's time to retire, you have yourself a nice little nest egg. So 20%, you can sort of, you know, you're not happy about it, obviously, but you can shake it off. That's not true for the man or woman who's 60 years old or very close to retiring. And they've worked their butts off for 40 years, and they've saved, and they've allowed compounding interest to work its magic for 40 years. And maybe they have $1 million in a 401k or an IRA, and boom, boom, 20% gone. Now you're down to 800 grand. What do you do? Well, your financial advisor is probably going to tell you, hang on there, Joe. You know how it goes, bud. Markets fluctuate. They go up, they go down. Just hang on. Well, Joe, maybe it does come back. But to get back to that $1 million, you need 25%. You think that's going to happen? You're close to retirement. Is it worth the risk of hanging on? Do you take some off the table? What do you do? Now it becomes a lot more difficult. Because your financial advisor just said, hey, it goes up, it goes down. Well, he wasn't there to tell you it was going to drop 20%. And that's a hard task. I wouldn't lay that at the feet of the advisor, but hell, I mean, it's his profession. He should know something. Maybe tighten up, maybe start building cash reserve for you, something, de-risk somehow. Maybe it's a boom. It's down 30%. Now you have $700,000. That's a lot of money. You worked very hard for that money. That's yours. That can make a huge difference. Depending on your lifestyle, your expenses, what you plan to do in retirement, where you plan to live, becomes very personal. I don't think anybody's going to be able to stop what's coming because nobody stopped the people who created it. Nobody stopped Dr. Frankenstein from creating his monster. And once you let it out of the bag, watch out. We have been awash in funny money, which is debt, up to our eyeballs at every level. The consumer, corporations, banks, state governments, national, federal governments. There's nowhere to go. This day of reckoning, this deleveraging, it will not be pleasant at all. Prepare yourselves. So let's look at some other broad data on the day here. The closing prices again on February the 8th. So let's look at crude oil. Closed at $52.71. Oil has made somewhat of a rally as well since the end of last year. Oil, if I recall, I think it did hit the technical definition of a bear market. I think it did drop 20% and then it's rallied up. I've had a lot of hedge fund analysts come out and say, you know, it was going to rally this year, and it has rallied thus far. But don't forget, last year, a lot of people thought oil was going to hit $100 because it hit the $60 range. It may even hit the low 70s at one point. Didn't come close to hitting $100. Went down, it went way down. So now you have a case of a slowing global economy, which was already the case, but now as data starts to pour in from some European countries, Italy's in recession, Germany had some very bad numbers. I spoke the other day about the Bank of England and their projections for the UK, especially with all the unknowns revolving around Brexit. The slowdown in China. Reserve Bank of Australia cutting their forecast for growth. Housing problems in Australia, housing problems in Canada. So you have a lot of growth issues here around the world. That doesn't bode well for the demand for oil. Well, what about the supply? Well, the U.S. continues to turn it out. But what about OPEC? Is there going to be supply? And is the supply cuts going to be enough to get the price back in the 60s, back up to the 70s? I'd be very surprised if it does, especially if we have a stronger dollar that comes because people start to see all of this anemic growth and they start to panic, and so they get into what they may view as a safe haven, the U.S. dollar. And so that would increase the value of the dollar. Oil is traded in dollars, so now the price of oil would likely decline because it would take fewer dollars to buy a barrel of oil. Those are typically the big pieces of the puzzle and of the equation when it comes to the price of oil. You obviously have the mechanics of supply and demand. You have the value of the U.S. dollar because oil is traded in U.S. dollars. And then you have geopolitical risks. Now, of course, there's other things to it, and it's very difficult to predict the price of oil. But those are the four big components. And when you look at each of those individually, the fact that oil now is trading around $52, I mean, my personal opinion, given the demand story, I wouldn't be surprised if it lingers here for a little bit or goes down. But again, I'm not here to predict day-to-day movements in what happens with oil. But another thing that we want to look at is the price of gold and silver. Because gold is obviously looked at as an inflation hedge and as a safe haven. Well, gold has been making quite a little move here recently. It's over $1,300 an ounce. It's now at $1,318. As of February the 8th, and we have silver that's made a nice little run itself, and it closed at $15.82 an ounce. So we have other factors here. What's going on here? Are people starting to worry about inflation? because of all of this money printing that's already taken place and now talks and rumors of other money printing taking place? Is it simply people are looking to hedge themselves and they want an insurance policy? So they're going to the yellow metal? Could be a number of things. It could be a supply and demand function. There hasn't been a lot of supply coming on the market because it's becoming more and more expensive to mine gold, because it's my understanding that these miners have to dig deeper and deeper now to find the precious metal. So there are a lot of factors at play. Now, in my book, The Cynic's Guide to Investing, from a diversification standpoint, we do advocate on owning gold and silver, and I would personally advocate owning gold and silver physically, not the paper, but actually having gold bars, silver bars, and coins. Now, if you take the approach of, say, hedge fund manager Ray Dalio of Bridgewater & Associates, which is the world's largest hedge fund, I believe they have about $160 billion in assets under management. His firm really preaches diversification, not fancy, you know, market timing or anything like that, but diversification. And he advocates for having about 7.5% of your portfolio in gold. It works for him. I mean, it does conserve your purchasing power at the end of the day. I truly believe that. I believe it is a store of value, not like the U.S. dollar. If you look at, I mean, and we went through this in The Cynic's Guide to Investing, and I'll do other things on this podcast and on YouTube where you can see things visually. But if you price a lot of things in gold, it becomes very interesting. Obviously, we price everything in dollars, but if you actually do the conversion and look at how things are priced in gold over time, you see a whole bunch of volatility when it comes to things being priced in dollars. But when it's priced in gold, you see a lot less volatility. You actually see stability. And that's one of the core components of what money is supposed to be. It's supposed to be stable. So we'll look at that as we continue. And then lastly here, before I sign off, what is the bond market telling us? Because the way I look at it, the stock market, those are the junkies. That's the drug addict who always wants a hit. And then you have the bond market. Those guys seem to be more of the adults in the room. Well, what has the bond market been telling us? Well, if you look at the 10-year, it's now yielding 2.63%. Back in November, it was yielding 3.23%. So that's a 22% change in yield over a couple months. Now, if you understand bonds, there's an inverse relationship between the price of the bond and the yield of the bond. So if the price of the bond goes up, the yield goes down. Okay, and that's what central banks the world over were doing. They were buying their home country's debt, which bid up the bond price, which pushed down the yield. So their borrowing costs were cheaper. They were monetizing the debt. Well, again, I said earlier, people might be flocking to U.S. dollars or U.S. securities. Well, they're looking at the Treasury. They're looking at Uncle Sam as a safe bet. Now, in a bad neighborhood, Uncle Sam may be the best-looking house. Doesn't mean it's a good house, but all things are relative. I got to put my money somewhere. Might as well put it in the best house. And right now, it's a logical reason to put it in Uncle Sam's pocket, despite the insanity that's going on here, just because it's that much crazier everywhere else. So we have this safe haven play. We got people bidding up the price of gold. We got people bidding up the 10-year note, the 10-year bond. So where's that money coming from? Is it going to start coming out of equities because people don't have a risk tolerance, so they don't want to be in stocks? They'd rather be in bonds? It's going to get real interesting. I've been saying for a long time that I expect in this new market paradigm that there's going to be a lot of decoupling. things that might usually trade in tandem might decouple, and vice versa. Things that usually trade inverse are going to trade together. There is a lot of volatility. Sometimes you look in the currency markets, if you follow the currency markets, to have a percentage move or something close to a percentage move in the currency markets is very volatile. You can see that in stocks on a daily basis. In currencies, it's rare. But we're seeing more and more of that as we go along here because there's so much uncertainty. Where do people go? What are the safe bets? Is the US dollar a safe bet? Is the Japanese yen a safe bet? There's too much going on with uncertainty with Brexit. So despite the strength and the demand for the British pound, there's too much uncertainty. It becomes a binary situation. It's either going to spike to the upside or it's going to collapse. People don't want to take that risk. You have such a slowdown in Europe. Well, what's going on with the euro? Is that a safe place to park your money? You got housing crisis coming to light in Australia and Canada. Plus, those are two commodity currencies, so do you really want to put your money there? You want to put your money in China, a communist country, who, believe you me, in the event of a crisis, they will shut everything down. You will not get your money out of there. So do you want to buy Chinese yuan? Do you think that's a safe place to be? We are now very much in a relative world. Are we the best-looking house in a bad neighborhood? Many people think so. How long will that last? Don't know. There's a lot of unknowns. There's a lot of unknowns because we've allowed politicians and central bankers the world over to go unchecked, to say, this is the best thing for you, this is the best medicine. Now this medicine may be the thing that kills us. So a lot more to cover, folks. I'm going to sign off. You enjoy your nice weekend. This is the Capital News. I am Alex Caritas. Godspeed.